Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shack of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day there and welcome to another Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute and School of Politics and International Relations. With me in the studio is my colleague Paul Pickering, Professor Paul Pickering, also from the Australian Studies Institute, a very storied historian of his own right and a long-term ANU luminary. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
And with us, as always, is Dr. Maria Taflaga from the School of Politics and International Relations, joining us remotely today, so not in the studio, but hopefully to all intents and purposes will sound as if she is. How are you, Maria?
Through the magic of podcasts.
Yes.
I'm very well, thanks.
Excellent. Now, what we thought we would do today is, bearing in mind that we're recording this on Tuesday morning, the morning after the final airing or the third episode in the triptych of documentaries or the docu-series called Nemesis about the period of coalition government after the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd years. So I thought we'd just, have a good conversation about that and some of the issues it raised and perhaps, think about it in the context of what's happened since but also some of those previous documentaries started off with Labor in Power in 1993, and then there was the Howard years, then there was the Killing Season. These have all been compelling television in their own right. What's your view, Maria, at the end of the series, the third episode of Nemesis, the one that focused on the Morrison government, the one in the middle, Turnbull, and the first one, Abbott? What's your impression as a bit of a scholar of the Liberal Party? You've done a lot of research in the Liberal Party over the years.
I thought it was a sort of fascinating exercise. I guess a couple of things that really stood out to me were, one, I think Malcolm Turnbull, I would imagine he might be quite annoyed that the episode of his prime ministership really just focused on the soap opera of his gaining power and then losing it. And not, it didn't really focus terribly much on the substance of his premiership, which was in stark contrast to the episode on Morrison, which was significantly more substantive and much more policy focused. Though, of course, there was the interesting omission of the robo-debt saga, which I think is a significant oversight in this series as a overall. But also, I suppose, the other questions around governance and so-called corruption that plagued this government in particular. The other thing that I thought that was really quite, I suppose, interesting about this series was just the overall emphasis on the sort of soap opera of it and the claims by some members that there had been a really successful government, which I don't think the documentary series necessarily lent evidence towards. And also one that is kind of hard for, I think, the average viewer to look back and articulate, whereas I think with someone like John Howard or Bob Hawke, I think it's a lot easier for the average voter to say they were successful governments and to really think of things that happened in those terms that really mattered.
Well, you've just named John Howard and Bob Hawke. Funnily enough, they're our only two multiple term PMs that you can think of in the last 30 years. I mean, it's astonishing when you think about it how Morrison in between 2019 and 2022 became the first Prime Minister since Howard had done it in 96. That is, Howard had done it for the first time in 96 to 98. That was the last time that a first-term Prime Minister had got elected and then still been there to lead his party to an election the next time around. That's an astonishing thing to think about in itself, how completely different politics has been since those big constellations of political authority that were represented by Hawke with Keating at the end and then Howard. Everything since has been a drama. What was your feeling, Paul, on those questions?
Well, interestingly, I found this most looking at the series as a historian as a document, and precisely because of the question you raise of why aren't these people better known for what they did as opposed to what they did to each other
or how they went?
yeah, exactly. And so it was a document about people's interaction with each other without really any substance to it, and so policy substance to it. Whereas with Howard, you could talk about the GST. Hawke, you could
talk
about
work choices.
Work choices. With Hawke, you could talk about the big, consensus and
Medicare. A lot, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, and really, what would you talk about with Turnbull? I thought one of the best comments was that when he went down the track of innovation and so forth, he was really telling people that they might end up unemployed as a result of technological change.
Yeah, what was that comment that someone made that he says technology and innovation and that just is read by a lot of people as a machine is going to do your job?
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, that's.
Well, the Nats would see it like that.
and the other interesting point was that many of his colleagues said that the long campaign meant that he ended up with nothing to say. But in fact, he started off with really nothing to say.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken about this before, but I've long had this theory, having been around in the press gallery all through this period, that Turnbull was what we had underappreciated, we being sort of the voters and the commentariat, anyone analysing it. What we had underappreciated when Turnbull came back in 2015 when he replaced Abbott is that he was, taking back the leadership that had been taken from him by Abbott at the end of 2009 when he'd got way out in front of the party, as most people interpreted it, over climate change, over emissions trading, which he was seeking to negotiate with the then Rudd government over. And the Turnbull that we saw come back into the leadership, which by now was in government, so I mean he was Prime Minister, he had none of the ambition that he had back in 2009. The things for which he was known, his commitment to the Republic, his commitment to emissions trading, his commitment to same-sex marriage or marriage reform, these kinds of things, they were all put on the back burner because that was the Faustian pact that he had entered into with the right of the party, the more conservative in the party, in agreement for knocking off Abbott in 2015. So, yes, you can be the leader because you've got a good relationship with voters and you have a better than even chance of saving us at the next election. But no, you can't raise any of the things for which you actually are popular. And that was the problem. They took a guy who was popular with voters among Liberals and they stripped him of the things, or he agreed to be stripped of the things for which he was popular among voters, the things that made him modern and moderate and progressive and so forth. And so you had this kind of period of drift. You had sort of kookiness under Abbott, all kinds of wacko things happening, knighting the Prince Philip and the like. And then you had the sanity of Turnbull, but it was a sort of a hollowness to it. Yes, he proceeded very purposefully with the National Energy Guarantee, for example, the so-called NEG. And he took it to the party room twice, but he never took it to the House of Representatives because he was scared that he was going to be rolled, or there was going to be a mutiny of at least some Nats and backbenchers, even though he probably would have got it through with Labor support anyway. And so he ended up having that whole problem of looking a bit pointless.
Well, I think it actually kind of points to what I think is actually the story of this government, right, which is essentially policy reversals. Abbott was elected to reverse much of the agenda of the Rudd-Gillard years.
Yeah, particularly the climate, the carbon tax, as he called it.
That's right. Yeah. Virtually every achievement Tony Abbott had was actually covered in this documentary series because he governed for such a short amount of time. And so much of his time in office was defined by reversing a set of promises and a type of compact he had with the electorate that he wouldn't change very much. And then, afraid of being a Malcolm Fraser, he introduced that infamous budget that we, you know, the 2014 budget. Mm. And I think what is interesting about Turnbull is that, you know, I agree with you that, you know, he made the Faustian bargain with the Nationals, ushering in for the first time that the written agreement with the coalition, which had previously just been a gentleman's handshake, which is actually really important institutional development that is secret and understood.
Yes, in my view, inappropriate, yeah, because of that secrecy. Yeah.
I would say time is a critical factor here. I mean, the shows themselves are a compression of time. Mm. So they make things more dramatic than they are. Even those final weeks, which, of course, Mark, you had your, you know, is really pressed up against the glass there. So you can see the tension in a very short period of time. What I think it underlies is one crucial strategic mistake on Turnbull's part, which really wasn't canvassed in the sense that he came in with such popularity. People, I think across the electorate, people who normally aren't invested in politics, wanted to see the back of Abbott.
Mm.
Hence his popularity ratings went through the roof.
Mm.
That was the moment to go to an election.
Yeah, so this was in August, September of 2015.
Yeah.
When Abbott went over the cliff, as it were, when Turnbull uttered the famous, he's had 30 failed news polls and wished he hadn't. I should shout out to Peter Hartcher on this one, because my colleague Hartcher at the time was the only person who said, from what I could tell, the only person who said at the time that Turnbull will come to regret that 30 news poll metric. And I thought at the time, oh, come on, 30 news polls, that's a long way into the future, you know. But it actually happened. That's the way it played out. And when Turnbull had lost 30 news polls, they were, you know, they were killing him over it. They were coming for him, and they were coming for him using his own words about legitimacy and so forth.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think that at the moment where he took over, when there was such a shine, and he, if he'd gone to an election, he was likely to have won, and he was likely to have got then a series of backbenchers who owed their careers to him, then he wouldn't have needed that Faustian pact. He could have faced them down in a way.
Yeah, I agree. He could have, and as I was saying to you before, I think he could have laundered the replacement, you know, the sort of killing of Abbott, if I can put it like that, by putting it to the voters, effectively going to the voters straight away and saying, I've taken over, there's going to be restoration of sanity and sort of mainstream orderly politics here, cabinet government, all that sort of thing, and I'm putting it to the voters. And then my relationship as a prime minister, assuming I come through that, is with the voters. That's the primary responsibility I have, not to a bunch of factional hacks in the Liberal Party and the Nats.
I think that's such a heroic interpretation of what would have happened. I just don't think that trying to have a personal relationship with the Australian people can overcome the realities of who your colleagues are and the fact that you have to make internal deals with them. I mean, another way to interpret what Turnbull did, you know, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. You know, in hindsight, going to an early election probably would have suited him and served him better, because he would have had greater authority and been able to dominate his party, which is what he would have needed to do to be successful. But you could say that Turnbull, by showing restraint, had actually learnt something about himself, about his previous time as leader, and about the mess that the Rudd-Gillard years had sort of made, which is, you know, why he chose to sort of try to demonstrate his credentials as prime ministers. And if you think about that, that's quite a positive trait. And if you think about the early days of his premiership, they were kind of actually structured around trying to actually have debates, like the one around the GST, for example.
Which he wasn't happy about because, in fact, he thinks that Scott Morrison was front-running on that as treasurer and causing all kinds of problems and accused. We saw this in Nemesis, you know, there were Morrison and he had sort of set tos about this because Turnbull was of the view that Morrison was you know promoting this idea and causing the government kind of friction in those early days and making Turnbull's leadership look a bit disorganized.
Yeah, but there is a bigger structural question there, which we've talked about before on this podcast, which is, well, I mean, if you want people to have substantive debates, like it actually has to be a bit messy and it has to have like some degree of uncertainty, yes. You know, which is something that characterized the Hawke years famously. We all celebrate that. And I do think that's actually a question for us as citizens and particularly the media to sort of really actually reflect on. And I, you know, for whatever reason, we all say, yes, debate is important. We should have disagreement, blah, blah, blah. But then we go back to, once again, criticizing people for having like minor disagreements on, you know, within a broad amount of consensus within a group of people who feel like there should be smaller amounts of tax, for example.
But isn't that in both the case of the Gillard and Turnbull, they're hanging on by the skin of their teeth and that any substantial debate might produce someone crossing the floor, whereas I don't think Hawke or Howard ever got into the situation where they were worried about losing the vote in the House of Representatives. And so that changes the nature of the engagement.
It does tend to focus the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it does exactly. And I mean, and the bizarre attempt to get another vote with Peter Slipper, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an act of desperation. I have to say as a footnote too, Maria, I'm always happy to be accused of a heroic interpretation.
Look, I think we should also say for the sake of completeness that we had Malcolm Turnbull on this podcast and I did put to him that very point about whether, in fact, I tried to get him to concede a number of things that I thought the government could have done better. And, like most prime ministers, he did everything right, by and large, you know, and that is the case. I'm not singling out Malcolm Turnbull for this. I've not met a prime minister who didn't do basically everything right and was misinterpreted. And Scott Morrison's, you know, the exemplar of that kind of thing, never did anything wrong. But Turnbull did say it was the one thing in which he conceded that perhaps he should have gone to the election in 2015, late 2015. And then he put forward the argument, he said something like, but we didn't have any money. Abbott had done very little fundraising. The Liberal Party was in no state to fight an election. You know, he was in touch with, obviously, Brian Loughnane, the federal director, and the party was in no sort of preparedness for a federal election. And, of course, we know when the election did happen, almost 6 months into 2016, that Turnbull tipped in $1.75 million of his own money to, you know, bolster the party to get it over the line. And he rather unwisely made a bit of a crack about that during Nemesis as well, just emphasising how different his life is from just about everyone else's. But it is interesting, you know, to your assertion about it being a heroic interpretation, Maria, I'd say this, that the problem for the Turnbull premiership was that it had a lot of promise in 2015 and by 2016 it had deflated virtually all of it before it got to the election. And that's actually why I say had it gone to an election, had Turnbull gone to the polls on the basis of having changed the prime minister and restoring cabinet government and everything else and the general feeling of sort of sanity that prevailed as a result of Turnbull's takeover, I think the government was in good shape to survive. I mean, it had let's not forget, Abbott won 90 seats to 55 to Labor's 55 in 2013. There was a huge buffer there. Turnbull lost all but one of those seats in the election in 2016. And I don't think that would have happened in 2015. And I think once he lost all but one seat, he was finished from that point.
He actually conceded that.
Yeah, and so had he gone in 2015 when he was ascendant, when there was a lot of good press around, when there was a sort of a sense in the community of kind of relief that the bizarreness of Abbott's government was over, I think that would have bolstered his authority and probably given him more legitimacy to take on the chieftains in his party.
Almost certainly. I don't disagree with any of that. My point is actually slightly different. It's about Turnbull, I think, having actually tried to undergo a process of reflection, having lost the leadership in 2009, which ironically, and which Willacy didn't really point out, is actually almost mirrored in how he lost it in 2018, with the sort of sensible, hard-nosed right, some of the very same people, but who were then in 2009 in more junior roles, basically busting out the same set of moves, or rather responding to the same set of pressures in the sense of the party not being able to find a way to come together on climate change. So I guess to reiterate it, you know, Turnbull, I think, has actually reflected on, or had reflected when he became Prime Minister, on the fact that there were parts of his character that made him ill-suited to running a political party, and that his management of that political party and its requirements, he failed at. And John Howard had a similar experience and lost the leadership, you know, in a similar way, and came back as Prime Minister operating in a different way. And I think that's what I was trying to say.
It's a very good point.
Was attempting to do. And because he lost all of his authority after losing the second largest majority in post-war history, yeah, he was cooked. He was completely cooked.
Yeah, it's a good point. He had overlearned the lesson, in a sense, of losing the leadership. And the way I described it at the time was that there was deeper emotional scarring about having lost the leadership than had been sort of outwardly appreciated, I think. And it showed up in this almost paranoia about keeping the party sweet rather than worrying about the voters. And the trouble was, it was the reason, same, very similar sort of reason why Rudd got control of the Labor Party in 2006, and that is the hardheads in the party in both cases decided this dude has a relationship with the voters. This dude can take us to victory at the next election. And that's why Labor went to Rudd, even though he didn't have the kind of factional basis. It's why the Libs, desperate in 2015 as they were sort of heading for disaster, heading for the rocks, decided to go for Turnbull. And they didn't, you know, the fact that he agreed to sort of keep the party sweet and governed all the time with one eye over his shoulder, I think turned his government into a far less creative and ambitious operation. I don't discount at all, Maria, your very valid point that there is a sort of a fundamental nature of the party reality that needs to always be taken into account here, and perhaps no amount of behavioural change could have overcome some of those things.
The final thing I'll say about Turnbull is that, you know, he really sort of struggled with the, I suppose, razzle-dazzle of politics, you know. Like, if you recall, if you cast your mind back to that time, it always looked like the government was about to blow up along ideological lines, and that Turnbull was trying to, like, wrestle cats through the Senate, and it all just looked like it was never going to come off. And then he would pull the rabbit out of the hat, and the legislation would go through, like the schools deal, for example, which is probably the most significant reform that he landed and is sort of partially still in place. But it just never looked like they were crushing it. So he never got the credit for
basically to crush it with a one-seat majority, though.
Indeed. But he just never got the credit for basically grinding out result after result when no one thought he could, even though actually, like, they did grind out result after result, except for obviously the last one on the neg where the whole show blew up. And I think that's sort of part of the kind of idea about, like, whether or not a government is actually traveling well, you know. Mm. And I think that's an important part of – like, why his time in office is, well, why it was so focused on the drama of it all, because I guess it was consumed by the personality drama of it all, even though he was trying, and I think actually broadly speaking, successfully, a prime minister geared towards substance.
Well, it was nice to have a prime minister who was capable of you know, articulation, who understood language, who could explain things. I mean, yes, he was loquacious and prolix and all of those things at times, and perhaps some voters were never going to relate to him. And Peter Credlin's Mr. Harbourside Mansion jibe during the election campaign was absolutely devastating. I mean, that didn't go unnoticed on the North Shore and didn't go unnoticed everywhere else as well. So,
Yeah, and I mean, he trotted out this notion that, well, he entered politics at 50 and that explains a lot of his mistakes in dealing with the electorate. And he also had the hide, and I think it was, I think he was being disingenuous, as Barnaby Joyce, as Barnaby said at one point in time, about, well, these bullying billionaires, as if, you know, he you know, sort of the pot calling the kettle black. Even though he wasn't a billionaire, he was a multimillionaire. But this idea that he had, I think he was ironic in some of the comments that he said on the show in a way that the others weren't.
Well, yeah, it's a good point. It was, and it's interesting you make the point about disingenuous, correct pronunciation, disingenuousness, because in a way, and I suppose this is what you're saying as well, Maria, we'll have to take a break here, obviously, but there was a sort of a disingenuous nature to Turnbull's premiership because you knew that he stood for things different than necessarily the things that he was preoccupying himself with. And that kind of thing really, you know, that sort of authenticity problem really does start to erode a government, and, you know, you can sort of smell the weakness within it as well as outside of it. And I think it sort of led to the feeling that it was a bit of an ersatz sort of government rather than, and, you know, Howard's, you never had that impression at all. Howard was very strongly, you know, he had that sort of conservative bead, but he also had the understanding of where the mainstream voters were, and he sort of navigated those two things, kept them in tandem, as it were, for most of the time. And it was you know, it was a successful exercise in political governing. We really haven't seen it a successful exercise in political governing since Howard, and that's perhaps what we're starting to see now, but we shall see. I mean, the reversal on stage three is perhaps a good example of that. Let's take a quick break and come back and perhaps talk a little bit about now the third trimester of that series Nemesis.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. It is, as you were just saying, Maria, the largest and most awkward. It was also, in some ways, I thought, Paul, perhaps maybe this is a bit unfair, but possibly the most boring episode as well. Like, it was, you know, why do you think that was? I mean, the nature of the beast?
Yeah, well, I found it the most boring. And I think partly, almost entirely, that's because there wasn't a challenge.
A leadership change.
There wasn't a leadership challenge in that period.
So you didn't have all the intrigue that absolutely.
Yeah, there were no machinations going on, other than the fact that, I mean, it was more about his engagement with the electorate rather than his relationship to his colleagues. And in fact, they tried to manufacture some of that in a way that it probably was, well, I think it was definitely less important to his, I mean, he mucked it up himself.
There was no sense, Maria, was there, of Morrison really being under challenge after he'd won that miracle 2019 election?
No, because I mean, it actually goes directly to the point of authority. He won a miracle election, and therefore he had a great deal of authority. That's interesting, because I actually found this to be the most interesting episode from my perspective. But I guess it possibly reflects just a difference in taste. I mean, I did think it was interesting that they really kind of, I suppose, front-loaded the moderate critics, but not necessarily the right-wing critics of Morrison, of which there were many. Early on in the episode, you certainly saw those, Erica Betts, for example, complaining about how much money they spent, which proved to be quite important to the sort of dying days of Morrison's prime ministership and standing. And then, of course, you sort of had, I suppose, James Patterson as a sort of more right-wing critic. But, you know, I actually thought that in some ways that the sort of deconstruction of Morrison's premiership was possibly more devastating than the other two, because it really did sort of go to both character and governance, i.e. competence. And even though I think it was actually quite a good point they made, and one that we should remember, that, you know, he did govern through the pandemic and was very successful on quite a few fronts, you know, it did ultimately sort of reflect someone whose inability, I suppose, to move past certain personal characteristics or personal preferences ultimately brought them down, both internally. I mean, the whole point about, like, Frydenberg becoming leader again was just sort of a bit nauseating, that there was just yet another leadership challenge being cooked up. But also, I think I made that point earlier that, like, actually quite a few of the scandals that racked that government were not even covered by this documentary because they ran out of time.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seemed to me like it was an episode for a different documentary. Precisely because of the dynamics of it. And in relation to your point about him being successful, and for part of it during the pandemic in particular, I think that almost was it. That was conceded by his opponents. There's that a comment from Mark McGowan, who refuses to give the comment, which obviously they're expecting to be negative. And there's the bit by Dan Andrews, which almost sneaks in and sneaks out, where he recognises that that Morrison did some good things. So I think that changes the dynamic at that point, but it still doesn't get it into – I mean, it seemed to me to be an episode about the failure of a government rather than the internal failure of a party which led to a failure of the government.
Yeah, I would sort of broadly defend the form of this kind of documentary, because it cannot deconstruct policy. It cannot afford to dwell too long in one particular area or go into too much detail. It's really about getting inside accounts of what was happening inside the party and what was happening inside the government, what people actually thought, as distinct from what was the official line at the time. And to that extent, it's an extremely intriguing process. It can't do everything. It can't do all those other things as well. But of course, it does have its limitations in that regard. And so we don't get a lot of policy. I mean, for example, one of the things that you could say about the Morrison government having won the 2019 election is that it won that election by essentially not being Bill Shorten, by tearing to pieces Labor's very extensive and ambitious manifesto, which had a number of new taxes and sort of imaginative policies. It was a bold manifesto that Labor was putting forward, at least in terms of, you know, contemporary politics. It showed up, it was a form almost of hubris from opposition, which is a contradiction in terms, but there was this sense that Labor was transitioning to government before it got to the election. And Morrison saw that, the advertising man, the opportunist, the communicator saw how to deconstruct that and did it very well. And, you know, that sort of one-man show got them over the line. Their real only policy justification for election in their own right, other than what they weren't, was the stage 1, 2, 3 tax reforms. And that was all legislated in 2019 from memory. So really you had a government that even by the end of the year in which it had obtained re-election, Morrison had only been there a year or so before that, you had a government that had no real agenda. And had it not been for COVID coming along, it would have been in deep and profound trouble anyway. I mean, look what they dredged up, the ridiculous religious discrimination bill, for example, when they were sort of finally looking around for something to do, and suddenly they were producing a bill which was the response of zero public clamour, and yet they were pretending it was some central matter of defining the rights of Australians going forward, and it eventually fell over, it eventually collapsed internally. But the government, you know, this is the point really about the Morrison government, is that you subtract the pandemic and all of the emergency measures they had to undertake and the all-consuming nature of that right through that term, and you really have a government that's doing nothing and really stood for nothing. And it showed. It showed. It not only and bear in mind that when the pandemic hoves into view, Morrison is in deep trouble over the bushfires. Mm-hmm. And sports rorts has come out at the start of that year as well, I think, the first revelations of that, the audit office report, you know, the colour-coded spreadsheets and all those sorts of things. We know there were other difficulties the government had, but essentially it was a government that was really, really had – it was like the dog that caught the car, right? Yes, it had won the election. It hadn't expected to, and it just didn't really have an agenda for it.
Yeah, and I guess to build on the points that both of you have made, right, like – I think that was actually kind of the point, is that the government had been reduced down to, like, this is an exaggeration, but effectively like a one-man band. And so in some ways...
And that one man was a bit strange.
Yeah, well, he also wanted to be a one-man band. Mm.
That's right. And so, Paul, you were talking about how the dynamics of the show shifted because colleagues were no longer quite relating to each other. And, you know, and that you can sort of see how that is a product of one, Morrison's leadership style, but two, COVID isolation actually really reinforcing that dynamic. And so all of these relationships are actually in large part these individuals relating to either Scott directly or his actions. And, you know, I think your point about hubris, Mark, is sort of spot on, and Christopher Pyne very helpfully put that one up in lights. But John Howard, in a very sort of subtle and courteous way, kind of made that point where he said that the government had nothing to offer in terms of an economic future, right, which Morrison chose to contest.
Now, one of my favourite moments in the third episode, was quite early, was when Russell Broadbent recounts the story about how he's having dinner with Ted Baillieu and Petro Georgiou, liberal moderates, ex-politicians in a sense, and he's used to them ribbing them, and they start telling him about this, right, this is sort of 2019, 2020, just in the toward the end of 2019. You know, of course, cities are bathed in smoke, the bushfire emergency has been going on for some time now. People have already died. And they start telling him that the Prime Minister has left the country on a Jetstar flight. And he says, oh, you know, don't be ridiculous. That wouldn't happen. You know, he just assumes they're ribbing him, and they show him the phone. I just thought it was such a telling moment. It was a great way of conveying the incredulity, which I think the whole nation felt at that moment, that the Prime Minister had left, that he'd instructed his office, which, by the way, instantly got the blame for the subterfuge, as is the former Prime Minister's wont. But, the media weren't being told where the Prime Minister was. The normal protocol of putting out a statement and having an acting Prime Minister and so forth, that hadn't happened. And Broadbent was just flabbergasted.
Yeah, it was a shocker. And particularly the excuse was that he'd promised his family a trip. That's
just
fine.
Irrelevant. It's just irrelevant.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's fine to promise your family a trip, I guess, but not when you're a prime minister during a national crisis. Mm. And, of course, then that totally he was then totally unable to be prime minister when he got back in terms of the way in which he engaged.
Yeah, because everything after that was about trying to repair the fact that he'd been gone, that it had been a secret, that he'd said, "I don't hold a hose," in an interview as some sort of justification. Everything then was about trying to patch up, which could never be patched up, the egregious insensitivity of that.
Right, and one of the most, telling moments for historians to linger over is that encounter that he comes that's filmed with people who are victims of fire, where no one will shake his hand, and he's desperate to actually put his hand on someone's shoulder, or and then he turns his back and walks away from.
Yeah,
I mean it's a shocker. And I mean they didn't recognize the potential for that. So it was so ham-fisted.
Well, they did in a sense, because even when my memory, I remember thinking this at the time, my memory is that he came back early from the Hawaii trip, because he had to. But then there was a period of some days before he went to the fire ground, because they knew that this was basically going to be, you know, very difficult. It was going to result in some confrontations with people who'd lost everything and who were under extreme circumstances. And I think they eventually had to do it because they couldn't delay it forever, and they had to do it, and they went down there, and it was the PR disaster. But that incident you mentioned, probably the signature one where he grabs the woman's hand and basically makes her shake hands with him, and she says, "I'll only shake hands with you if you promise to do more for this community," or whatever it is, at which point some bozo steps in, some old guy, and starts basically manhandling her away from the Prime Minister, which I was infuriated. I'm sure many people were. And the Prime Minister at that point showed an utter absence of leadership, because he should have then stepped in and said, no, this is important. The things need to be said here. I'm here to listen. I'm here to – you say what you have to say. I'm here to help. A true leader would have done that, would have seized that moment and tried to turn that negative into something else. Instead, you see Morrison sort of standing off the back of this as this old guy counsels this woman not to be rude to the Prime Minister. The whole thing was a debacle.
And I mean, it wasn't even a failure of leadership. Well, of course it was, but it was also a failure of Morrison, the marketing man, not to see that was going to be an absolute disaster right there and then.
Yeah, so, and a failure of humanity, frankly.
I mean, I think that incident is a really strong crystallization of, I think, a lot of the themes that had circled around Morrison and the Liberal Party for many years around his maleness, right, and his masculinity. And that incident where I think he is actually the old guy is either the mayor or the local councillor for the National Party.
Well, he should have stayed out of the world.
Yeah, yeah. But it's sort of because if you actually recall that, you know, part of Morrison's justification for being away was he essentially blamed Jenny and the kids, and Jenny and the kids became this sort of meme. And the girls, that's right. That became a kind of meme, right, a satirical meme that people were throwing around. And if you recall, a lot of the in the media debate around whether or not Morrison's absence was a problem or not was definitely driven along ideological lines, but there was also a clear gender split as well. And I think people who are not really that political, but like Gretel Colleen, just like completely unloading on right-wing kind of hacks defending the Prime Minister became these kinds of lightning rod moments. And it had come after the sort of hubris of winning the election, those reports about Morrison's inner circle in The Australian, you know, these sort of power puff pieces in which like there was like no women in his inner circle. And it's actually reflected in the way that women participate in this series.
Absolutely.
They are always on the periphery. They are never central key players, in part because Julie Bishop is not interviewed, and in part probably to do with some of the reticence of someone like a Maurice Payne, who's just not that kind of a political operative. But I mean, the reality is that they're kind of like a Greek chorus.
Absolutely.
You know, looking into this endless male kind of show. And I thought it was really, like, I found it amusing when Paul Barry, the pollster, sort of said, Tony Barry, yes, my apologies. He sort of complained that Labor turned the 2022 election into a personality contest. But that's exactly how Morrison won the 2019 election campaign, by leveraging he was just this ordinary bloke who loved the Sharks and was a great guy, you know. And I thought it was quite fascinating that one of the things Morrison seemed to most sincerely regret was that he, quote, lost his emotional connection with the Australian people. Whereas I think one of the key themes of this episode, with his colleagues, with the Australian people, and potentially even with himself, is who is this guy?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a very good question.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we've talked mostly about the episode that we all said we thought was the worst one.
Well, I suppose it's the most recent one. I still think it was fascinating, but it was more recent. I suppose some of the things were a bit less novel in the mind because they were a bit more recent in the mind, like a bit less novel to see when you saw them. You know.
Yeah, and I mean, Maria's point is absolutely correct. Throughout all three episodes, including the one involving Julia Gillard, women and the role of women is quite muted. Mm. I think that's not a result of them not wishing to be interviewed. It's just the extent to which those interviews are obviously less used.
Well, it frames Maria a government that's like a three terms of government that started out with a cabinet of 18 men and one woman, and sort of grudgingly and symbolically addressed that to some extent. And we heard someone say in the episode last night that in the end, Morrison had more women in his cabinet than any prime minister had had up until that point. But none of them had any real sway. None of them had any power. As you say, Morrison's inner circle was all men. His staff were overwhelmingly men, and there were no women interviewed in the series who were kind of movers and shakers. Perhaps Cash came closest at one point.
Indeed.
But really just in terms of her sort of pivotal, position in WA as a kind of a conservative from WA along with Cormann. But
I think by then had started to run into trouble under Morrison's time in office.
She dies sobbering though, whatever that is.
Yeah. Sobering, was the one was going to take.
That was actually one of the big victims of the language.
The English language.
Yeah. Hey, just in the last couple of minutes, I just want to get your reflections on, because I was quite happy in a way, and this might sound strange from a journalist, but I was quite happy that there weren't journalists involved. It was all just first, you know, it was all the players involved in the party room. And the few exceptions to that were the aforementioned Tony Barry and a couple of really senior public servants, Martin Parkinson, who'd been head of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, Jane Holton, former head of health and who'd been playing that role in the vaccine task force. Both of their interventions were spectacular, I thought. Parkinson, Maria, describing the failure on climate change as the biggest public policy neglect he had ever seen in his lifetime, and Jane Holton explaining quite graphically her response to Morrison's claim that vaccine acquisition is not a race.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that sort of goes to my point about I thought it was really interesting that Bridget McKenzie said it had been a really successful government. And I just kept wondering by what criterion, and perhaps the criterion is literally just the centrality of the National Party, which certainly made itself more important as time went by and extracted lots of resources and goods out of that time of office. But, you know, we're actually still like living with the legacy of those decisions and changes, and to be blunt, not much of the legacy of that government, of its actual legislative changes, are still in place, and its stage three tax cuts are about to be amended. Some of the most successful, innovative and bold bits of the education reforms were later watered down. You know, we're onto our third sub deal, which, you know, at this stage, Labor's more likely to progress meaningfully. I'm sort of struggling to think of other initiatives that easily kind of come to mind, and the failure to adapt this country on climate change is an enormous economic loss and a massive giving up of our, you know, competitive advantage, which pretty clearly large parts of the coalition still don't think is an issue and is reflected in you know, the sort of subterranean policy and political moves around trying to attack the energy transition on the ground in rural Australia with the sort of poles and wires sort of stuff. So there's sort of what's changed, I suppose.
Yeah, and I mean the head shaker, or another head shaker, is the clip from Abbott saying, well, climate change is not a problem. In fact, it might be an advantage.
To the extent that it is a problem, it's better.
Yeah. I mean, that was just like, you think, well, yeah, that transforms us back to those bizarre years.
Yeah, so the coalition's learned a lot about how to frame its arguments, not like that, for example. But is there a paradigm shift or a kind of a values change in its private thinking? I think that what we might leave listeners with is this thought that Maria just mentioned, for example, the decision to back out of the stage three tax cuts, and that's obviously been a big play for Anthony Albanese to make, having to put his own integrity on the line to a degree. You know, he said, my word is my bond, and now he's changed that. I think they've changed it for reasons. They seem to have done it quite effectively, and they've got the opposition voting for it as well. But it will be interesting to think about what the next iteration of the ABC's Inside the Party Room documentaries show about this period. How much dissent was there within the cabinet? What were some of the arguments that were being put forward? And this, of course, won't be the only policy question. There'll be other policy questions and other concerns about how the government's travelling, perhaps how the government was travelling through the Voice period, for example. What was being said? What did people think privately about whether the PM should have committed the government so absolutely and fully and frontally on election night in 2022? They're the sorts of questions. So these documentaries kind of educate us about what's happened, but also I think how to think about what might be going on under the surface as events unfold now.
It seems to me that we're looking for the hero of the next period, aren't we? I mean, you know, who's the hero of the show? For me, it was bizarrely Barnaby Joyce. I mean, he seemed to be the most open about what he thought about and what he was going to do and what he did. And so who are we looking at in the current political class, if you like, who's going to be that person in this term and leading into the next election? Who's the hero?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what are the issues, whether it be, you know, the decision to stop Qatar Airlines coming in, for example, the relationship with Qantas, you know, some of the issues that have come up already in this term of government. Look, that's all speculation. We can do that in another couple of years' time when we or however long it is until there's a change of government, we get one of these documentaries again. But it's been a great pleasure. Hopefully for you sitting at home or wherever you are listening to this, been interesting to listen to as well. I've certainly enjoyed it. So Paul Pickering, Maria Taflaga, thanks very much.
Thank you for a great discussion, guys.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. It was great fun.
And that is Democracy Sausage for this week. You can contact us by email at democracysausage@anu.edu.au. Do so, and we'll see what we can do in terms of responding or if you have ideas for what we ought to do, we're always open to that. So look forward to any sort of feedback. And we'll talk to you again next week. Bye for now.